So where were we, you know, last week when we ended, kind of stepped off the path to take our break? We're at 1,536 years since creation, so a relatively short period of time comparatively to all of time, certainly in comparison to this eternal plan. But quite a while has passed. The world's population by Genesis chapter 5 has exploded. The end of chapter 5 rolling into chapter 6. So we're dealing with millions, if not a billion people. Large numbers. The problem, however, and we talked about this last week a little bit, is that man's numbers have grown, but as they grow, so does the gap. The gap between man and God. We had traced Cain's line, and we see that they're on one side of the world spiritually. On the other side is Seth's. But even Seth's line, we're going to see, is not what it's supposed to be, except for the one. God is, what did we say last week? He is so brokenhearted by man's direction. He's so brokenhearted by the choices that man has made. His decision to separate from God. God has decided, I'm going to wipe every living thing off the face of the earth. As he watches, as he sees the steady decline, the deterioration of the world's morals. He sees exactly one shining star. We introduced him last week, and that's Noah. Name meaning rest or comfort. And so finally, a break from the direction of the world. Unlike the rest of the world, Noah is righteous. He lives by the standard God has given him. He's blameless. He walks with God. He has a relationship. And we looked at that phrase and the fact that it's only used twice. And it's used back-to-back chapters, chapter 5 and chapter 6. God decides in this process of making the plan to destroy the world, that Noah is worth saving. Noah is the one through whom he can start over. He didn't have to recreate. He can preserve the one, bring him out on the other side of the destruction, and allow him to start over. So God lets him in on the plan. Noah's the first to hear about it. As far as we know, he is the only one that God tells. Any other dissemination of the information, Noah has to share. It's his job to spread the news, 2 Peter 2 and verse 5. So God knows, Noah knows. And it's a huge plan. Let's listen in. Moses, as he is inspired to write these first five books of the Old Testament, allows us to listen to some of these conversations. And we get to hear as God drops this bomb on Noah. I'm about to wipe out the world. Better yet, though, we're going to play pretend. You know how we do sometimes? I want you right now, in your mind, to put on your robe, to put on your sandals, and you're going to walk in Noah's steps. And this conversation is going to be between God and you for a few minutes. Chapter 6, verse 13. God says to Noah, or to us, the end of all flesh has come before me. The earth is filled with violence because of them. And behold, I'm about to destroy them and the earth. Now then, I want you to imagine that God pauses to take a breath. And that's all you've heard so far. And you've thrown yourself in this conversation. And so I'm going to play the part of me. Wouldn't that be appropriate? I'll be me. All flesh. Why are you telling me this, God? If you're going to destroy all of the world, if you're going to destroy all of flesh, good grief, don't tell me about it. Just do it. I'm going to lie awake at night and worry about when is this going to happen. And so just sneak up on me, keep it a secret, catch me unaware, and just wipe me out. Thankfully, though, there's no pause. Verse 14 follows right on the heels of verse 13. And God says, hold on. You know, you missed something. There's a key word. I said, I'm going to destroy them. Not I'm going to destroy you. You see, Noah, I have a plan. And you're part of it. So listen to me. We're going to pick up at verse 14 and we're going to go down through 21 and we're going to look at this plan. God tells Noah, tells us, you need to build an ark. All right, playing this part, if this is the conversation God is having with me, at this point I'm jumping up and down and I'm waving my hand. God, what's an ark? I don't want to interrupt you. I know you got a plan. I know you're trying to, but I don't understand. From the very beginning, Lord, what's an ark? So God explains, it's a really, really big boat. But you think about where they are. You think about what surrounds them. You think about what's not there. A sea. And so again, I jump up and down. God, what's a boat? And you can imagine if this is the conversation, God thinking, you know, this might not be the best idea at this point. I'm not sure I'm going to get this explained to him. So God says it's this watercraft thing. But if you'll just hold your horses, and I promise you, God would have had to have told me to hold my horses. Because I want answers. I want the details as it's going along. But God said, hold your horses, I'll explain everything. And so I have to step back and I have to be quiet for a minute. And God says, I want you to build it out of gopher wood. And you're going to make it 450 feet long. And you're going to make it 75 feet wide and you're going to make it 45 feet tall. And you're going to make it with three decks in it and it's going to have rooms on every deck. It's going to be waterproof inside and out. Be sure to put in a window and a door. You know, I've held my tongue about it as long as I can, God. Why? You know, that's a lot of work. Why? And God has to go, you know, I just told you I'm going to destroy the world. Well, I'm going to do it with the flood. And so here I am again. You know, God, I know you told me to hold my horses. But excuse me, what's a flood? Now, I want you to understand, as Noah hears this word, this is a new concept. Rain and flooding, they don't exist. Back in chapter 2 and verse 6, God has watered the earth with a mist. We're in this canopy. We're in this tropical world. And so he has blown Noah's mind. Or at least he blew mine. God says, it's a lot of water. Now just listen. Let me finish. I'm going to make a covenant with you. You can enter the ark, and you can take with you your wife, you can take your sons, you can take your daughters-in-law, and you're going to come out on the other side. But, oh, by the way, round up a male and a female of every kind of bird, every kind of animal, everything that creeps and everything that walks on the earth, and take them with you. No, God decides, chapter 7, make that seven pair of all the clean. And then two pair of the unclean. You know, it'd be nice if you changed when I pushed the button. And so we have this plan that Noah's been given that includes this massive floating zoo full of decks and rooms and just a few people and a whole bunch of animals. And God says, you know, you've also got to gather enough food for all of you. And then God says, no, that's not what I'm talking about, Noah. You can't drive through. You're not going to float the boat through McDonald's. You're not going to stop at KFC. You're going to have to round up the hay and the grain and whatever else you need to feed this floating zoo. One more thing, Noah. You have less than 100 years to get this done, so you better start looking for gopher wood. That's not gopher wood, by the way. That's just a gopher. And I want to pause for a minute and I want to explain that to you. Remember, God started at the beginning when he made the plan. He said, I'm not going to fight with man forever. I'll give him 120 years. But you got to do the math from there. Noah's 600 at the time of the flood. That means when God made that decision, Noah was 480. When are his boys born? After he turns 500. So you've already lost 20 years. Down to 100 years. By the time God speaks to him, he's already talking about sons and daughters-in-law. They've matured enough to marry. So we're looking at about 75 years probably from this final discussion for Noah to get ready to get on the ark. So he's got to get in a hurry. So let's go back in Noah's sandals for a minute. If this is me, okay, I'm like, seriously, God? No. Gopher wood's hard to find, and you can't stick the gopher on it and nail it together and make it qualify. I have no idea what an ark is. I have no idea how to build one. I have no concept of something that's 450 feet long. The flood, you lost me with that one, God. That's beyond my comprehension. And it's going to take a whole lot of tar to waterproof this massive floating zoo. Oh, by the way, God, I'm allergic to animals. So I really don't want to be cooped up with them in this big boat. I'm nearly 600 years old. My visa is maxed. Domino's, I'm not sure it delivers out here. So where am I getting all of this food? God, let's talk about this. You know, let's come up with some other plan. But I wasn't there. Neither were you. And so I'm extremely thankful to my God that it's Noah who's there. Because instead of the discussion, instead of me wanting answers and details and a blueprint to follow, instead of all of this argument and hesitation, God gets full, immediate obedience from Noah. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 22, Noah did according to all that God had commanded him. He lets God say his piece all the way to the end, the beginning of the plan to the end. And it very simply says Noah did what he was told to do. Thank goodness. Thank goodness God didn't have to go through all the rigmarole it had dealt with me. And thank goodness Noah did what he was supposed to do, because now you're here. So we jump down to chapter 7. Chapter 7 opens. God says it's time to load up. So we've had 75, 80, somewhere in there we've had some years pass. Noah's done what he was supposed to do. He's rounded up the food. He's built the ark. He has his family prepared. I want you to notice the emphasis in chapter 7 and verse 1. Then the Lord said to Noah, enter the ark, you and all your household. Now notice this. For you alone I have seen to be righteous before me in this time. What a statement. We're dealing with millions, maybe a billion, estimates of even a lot more than that on the face of the earth. And it's not even about Noah's family. God says, this is about you and you alone. You are the only one in all of this world that I've seen to be righteous. What a statement about Noah. And by God being able to make that statement, we know in advance that Noah's going to do everything he's supposed to do. That he's going to get this thing built and it's going to get off the ground and he's going to come out on the other side. So God says, load it up. Start 7 days from now. And again, verse 5, Noah did. God, how about a delay? You know, I'm a little bit behind. I hadn't found the penguins. I didn't get enough tar, so only half of... He's ready. He's done exactly what he was supposed to do, so that when God springs it on him, hey, we're a week away. Noah says, all right, I'm good to go. We're ready. So Noah does exactly what he's told to do. God closes the door. Verse 16, what a beautiful image. God says, I'm sealing you in for your protection. We're going to come back to that in a minute. And once God does that, the bottom falls out. We have never, nor could we imagine, anything like what he saw. You know, and we've joked, you know, we joke sometimes when it rains for 5 or 6 days in a row that we see animals walking by in pairs or we see Noah building. We have no concept of what this means. It rains for 40 days and nights. And the ark is lifted off the ground. Verse 17. Skeptics argue that, oh, it just had to be a local flood. There's no way 40 days and nights of rain is going to flood the whole world. There's no way this is global. Don't fall into that trap. Look down to chapter 8 and verse 2. Not only is it raining, and I'm sure we're talking about torrential rains, it includes the waters under the earth's crust exploding upward. It includes the floodgates of heaven as though this canopy that has separated the heavens, this canopy that has enveloped the earth in this tropical world, rips open. So you're talking about sheets and torrents of water from the sky, and oh, by the way, it's raining. The master of creation put into place at the beginning enough water to do this because he knew what was coming. The ark floats. The earth is swallowed. The earth is swallowed whole. It says the water is 15 cubits higher than the highest mountain. That's 22 and a half feet. Based on the measurements of the ark, that is the amount of water needed as she settles to clear the highest peak. It's mathematically accurate. Now then, there's nowhere to hide. If you've covered the highest mountain with 22 and a half feet of water, there's nowhere to go. And so there's not some last person standing on his tiptoes on the very top of the highest peak to get his breath who's going to survive. We're left with 8 people. And whatever animals are on the boat, not worried about the sea creatures. If Everest stood as tall as it does today, and there's a lot of speculation that the flood probably caused a lot of that disruption, and so the mountains get higher and the valleys get deeper and our canyons come into existence all at once. Well, even if that's the case, if it happens during the flood, it's still there, so it's still got to clear it. All right. So 29,029 feet, 22 and a half feet taller than that to get the ark over the top of it. You're looking at 29,051 and a half feet. Dude, that's a whole lot of water. But God's making a point. When I give the world a bath, when I wash away all the filth and the crud and I scrub it, I scrub it. I immerse it. I baptize it. I clean it. It has to be. Everything, verse 21 through 23, everything walking, everything crawling, everything in it, on the face of the dry ground that has the breath of life, has to die. Because that's the plan. And so God swallows the world whole. We're going to see this in a minute, for a year. The water continues to rise, finally levels off on day 150. after it started raining. And God says, that's enough. The waters finally ceased. The winds begin to blow. And the process of the water going down and then ultimately drying up begins. Now, I'm going to spare you all the dates because it can go on and you can look at every one of the dates in it. But I'm going to tell you this, and I'll show you on the next slide. Very quick timeline that you can glance at. From the beginning to the end, Noah and his family are on the ark for 377 days. They had a 30-day calendar, so that is 1 year and 17 days. That is a long time to be cooped up in a boat. It's a long time to be cooped up. If you think about this as a mother-in-law or a father-in-law, with your sons-in-law or daughters-in-law. It's a long time to be cooped up with two elephants, two rhinos, two hippos. Timeline there you can kind of follow. It's a long time to be floating around in the dark. It's enough time to think, God has forgotten me. It's enough time for the indoor plumbing to fail. It's enough time for you to be sick and tired of eating grain and hay and whatever vegetables you were able to pack and keep good for a year. I love my dog. But I'm not sure she and I need to live side by side every minute of every day for a year and seven. She got to go outside sometime. All right. I need to go outside sometimes to get away from her. There's no escape. There's no holiday. But I want you to see the most beautiful thing about this whole thing. And it's, you know, we talked about those wow passages. This is one that when I saw it several years ago, I was absolutely blown away by the connection. All right, chapter 8, verses 15 through the first part of verse 17. God spoke to Noah, go out of the ark. You and your wives and your sons' wives, bring out with you every living thing of all flesh that is with you, birds and animals and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. 377 days later, God never forgot Noah. God's making the ark float. God's keeping it from breaking apart in the winds and the water. God's keeping it from breaking apart when he grounds it on Mount Ararat. In chapter 6, verse 18, God told Noah before this all started, I'm making a covenant with you. I'm going to put you in the boat. I'm going to get you out of the boat. I guarantee it. In chapter 7, in verse 1, God says, load up. And so Noah, in faith, walks on the ark. Verse 16, God shuts the door. Chapter 8, in verse 1, it says, God remembered him. And he went back and he opens up the door. And that word we think of when you remember something, it's because you forgot it. All right, you finally remember where your keys are. It's because you forgot where you put them the first time. The Hebrew word doesn't mean that. It's the idea that they're a constant thought in God's mind, and God decided to act upon that thought, that enough time had passed that God could go rescue them. So the waters begin to go down. And finally, verses 15 and 16, God brings him through the flood and brings him out. You know, it's about the destruction of the world. It's about the cleansing process. But through it all, the thread is Noah. The thread is God getting him through the storm and getting him out on the other side. Noah and his family exit. They exit with the animals. Interesting thing in chapter 8, verse 13 and 14, there are two different Hebrew words used for dry. The one in verse 13 refers to the surface of the ground being dry, but it still being soft and marshy underneath where there's this little bit of crust. But you send the elephant out in it and he hits the crust and he breaks through and is flooded underneath still. Whereas some 57 days later, verse 14, The word means completely dry. And so it's time. And God brings them out and they're told to repopulate the earth. The animals are told in chapter 8, verse 17 to repopulate the earth. Man's told in chapter 9 and verse 1 to do the same. Some other things, for the first time, there is a division between man and animal. There's now fear. The animal's going to fear man. For the first time, Noah's told that you can eat the animals. And by the way, there's part of the reason for seven pair of clean. He needed an instant food source when he got off, plus the sacrifice system. The promise, the covenant, the never again will I flood the earth. Next time it'll be fire, and that being sealed with a rainbow. Side note, and I'll try not to get up on a soapbox, but of all the things in the gay and lesbian movement that bother me, the fact that they have abused God's rainbow may bother me the most. They've taken my promise and they've tried to turn it into something ugly. And that bothers me. Let's make some New Testament connection. Judgment, the final judgment, when God doesn't wash it but destroys it, the one that comes with fire, is going to be like the flood in that it's going to catch the world at large unaware. Going to catch the world at large unprepared. I'm not saying Noah didn't do his job. What I'm saying is the world ignored him. If the world had not ignored Noah, they'd have been lined up at the ark waiting. But they're not. They're unprepared. Most people in this world who've not seen the warnings of God, who don't know that there's a judgment day coming, and since we don't know exactly when it's going to be, we have to be ready every day, they're going to be caught going about their daily business. Matthew chapter 24. They're going to be marrying and giving in marriage and doing everything that they were doing in the days of Noah. When God says, that is enough. Jesus, go get them. From that time, or from right now, excuse me, until that time, however much time elapses between now and final judgment, it's just like it was when Noah preached. It is God's patience. It is God's mercy. It is God giving us time to get right. It is God giving us time to get inside the ark. But a third New Testament connection is this. God's patience will run out. God said, I'm not going to battle with man forever. I'll give him 120 years. That 120 years is up, and he didn't say, I'm going to give you one more day. He said, Noah, get on the boat. I'm sick of this. I'm fixing to baptize this world. When that happens at the end of time, there'll be no coming out on the other side in this world. He's going to wipe it out completely because his patience will run out. Little side note, a little different than we've done with the others, but we're going to interrupt it with some argument. There are, if you read and you start reading about the flood, the arguments against the flood, and there's a lot of them. And some of them vary in their forms. Some of them are extremely disrespectful. They're not just arguing science and opinion. They're very ugly about it, and it'll actually make your blood boil if you read the wrong ones. But a few of them, some of the arguments, there's too many animals to collect, too many animals to get on the boat. And when we think about animals, we think about various breeds, and we think about even multiple categories inside a breed. God said, I want you to collect kinds. And that's an entirely different thing than collecting breeds. When God says, go get two dogs, that's two dogs versus two coyotes, two weenie dogs, two poodles, two whatever. God has built within us, when he created man, the ability to have black and white and Chinese and he's done the same thing with the animal world. And so you can go get two dogs before the flood, come out on the other side, and what? We continue to manipulate genes and produce new breeds all the time. So we're talking about two kinds. And so you're not talking about these hundreds of thousands of species and breeds and all these things that we have today. Number two, the meat eaters, they couldn't have traveled with their lunch. You know, the lion can't sit next to the gazelle. There's no provisions for them. Well, fails to take into account that there's no evidence of meat eaters at all until after the flood. It's not until God starts talking about eating with blood and things and the animals being held accountable if they kill a man. There's no room to move. There's too much work for eight people on the ark. What happens for a large part of the year if you're a bear and you live in the north, or if you turn off the lights with your hamster? Animals go to sleep. And they're built within them the ability to hibernate for extended amounts of time. I would wager that for the most part, the ark was pretty quiet. Because God needed eight sane people out on the other side instead of eight insane people. It's not a global flood. It had to be a local flood. Well, if it's a local flood, first of all, pack up and move. All right. If God's trying to destroy you and he's going to flood your valley, move to the mountaintop. Number two, you cannot destroy the whole world's population and all the animals if it's limited to one area. Number three, if you want to talk science, the fossil record shows this massive upheaval in our world's history. You have to be able to explain the disappearance of the dinosaurs, and they take place after the flood. And you have to be able to explain the change in our atmosphere and the record in our atmosphere. And so you're not talking about flooding North Alabama. It won't work. Another argument, they're not big. The ark's not big enough. Even if you limit it to kinds, where do you put dinosaurs? Where do you put elephants? Where do you put... Well, for one, we're not told they had to be adults. You know, personally, I'm loading up the T-Rex. All right, I'm getting the itty-bitty one. All right, so he gets an itty-bitty cage by himself, and he's away from me. Besides, folks, this ark is massive. 450 feet is a football field and a half long. It's 75 feet wide and 4.5 stories tall. There is a lot of room on the ark. You start doing the math, and that is a volume of 1.4 million cubic feet. For every 100 cubic feet, you can load a ton of cargo. That's 14,000 tons. That's a lot of elephants. And we just needed two. There is not another ship on this earth built as large as the ark until 1884. And that's kind of a rendition of what the ark might have looked like. But I pointed to it because of the scale. How small you feel standing next to it. Oh, there's no way Noah could gather that many animals. If you're going to argue with me, at least read the book. Oh, how'd you get the penguins from the South Pole and the North American animals? Chapter 6, verses 19 and 20. God said, they're going to come to you. They're going to line up for you. Noah's not scurrying around the world sticking two rabbits in this pocket and two mice in that one and hoping the kangaroos follow him. God said, I got this under control. Here's your heads up real fast for next week, chapter 11. We're going to look at Babel. We're going to look at Abram's first call. And if you're going to go ahead and read ahead, I want you to connect chapter 11, verse 31 with Acts chapter 7, verses 1 through 4. And you'll notice the fact that Abraham's actually called twice. Kind of like the disciples. So here's our application. We're to do the same thing Noah did. Not in building an ark, not in gathering gopher wood and gathering animals and gathering food, but we're to get ready. And we're to do what we're told. We're to be prepared not for a flood, but for fire. We're to be prepared for the death, either my death at the end of my life, or Jesus' return in the end of it all. Noah did. Saved him. Saved his family. Are we doing the same? Number two, we're to preach while we prepare. Noah had 120 years from the time God made the decision, from the time we finally see him tell Noah, 100 years, 75 years, somewhere in there, and he's called a preacher of righteousness. And so Noah, every time he swings the hammer, is telling the man closest to him about what he's got to do to get ready. And we're supposed to be doing the same thing. But this is the part I want you to see. This is the part that I love. I said the line, the thread through the story is not so much about the flood as it is about Noah. No matter how much time passes from the time God makes a promise to us to its fulfillment, and no matter how dark the days are in between, God never forgets us. And God always keeps His promises. And so He's going to get us through the flood. He's going to get us through the fire. He's going to get us through this life and get us out on the other side. I'll show you something really fascinating as we get ready to close. The blue arrow points to the Wyoming, the largest wooden ship built since the ark. Built by skilled laborers, crewed by 14, twisted to pieces in a heavy sea. Pink one points to the Titanic. You know the story. Built by skilled laborers. It's unsinkable. Humbled by an iceberg. The one in the middle. Built by unskilled labor. Manned by eight. Piloted by God. Survived the water for over a year and it ran aground and everyone on it survived. Which one makes more sense to board? The one that God's involved with. You see, when you go to the cross, God's prepared the ark. He's opened the doors to heaven. He's opened the doors to the kingdom. He's opened the doors to salvation. He said, board. The flood's coming. And it's going to be a flood of fire. It's there. It's ready. It's the ark of your salvation. My question is, are you on board? If you've not obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ through the blood of the Son, through obedience, through faith and baptism, you're standing outside the ark. And if it sets sail without you, you are lost for eternity. It's time to get on board as we stand and sing.